off the ball.
GAA.
Not too many goals are scored outside the 21-yard line, and there's not too many players in the country that I'd back to score a goal from that distance out. Aaron Galan is one of them. He was outrageous at the weekend.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
Now then, it is coming up to the 2026 Masters at Augusta National, one of the great weeks of the sporting year. And I'm very happy to say we are joined by a two-time major winner and a man who knows a thing or two about Augusta as well. Retief Goosen, you're welcome to the show. How are you getting on?
All good. Thank you very much. Looking forward to watching some Masters golf next week. Should be fun.
What does Masters week look like for you these days?
Yeah, unfortunately, I'm not standing on the real first tee at Augusta, but I'll be hanging around there a little bit for a couple of days, Monday to Wednesday, around the Augusta area, catching up with some friends and some corporate people. And yeah, I'll probably one day go and watch a little bit, but it's not so much fun outside the ropes that is inside the ropes.
It's pretty fun for all of us, but I can imagine it's no fun at all when you know exactly what it's like to be in the final grouping on Masters Sunday. I'm sure it's a bit of a drop down. Do you get any sort of joy from the art of watching golf at all these days, or were the highs of the height of your career just so bloody high that you can't really get that enjoyment out of being a fan?
Yeah, I tend to watch a little bit, but it's not that I'm going to be sitting on the couch watching every shot of everybody playing next week. But Sunday, the last nine holes, that's when it all starts, and I'll be watching that. But yeah, you know, having had a chance there, finishing second twice and third twice, it would have been nice to have been knowing that you can go back there sort of every year and go and play, but not to be. But yeah, I enjoy watching golf, but more the majors, like watching that last day and see how it all unfolds.
When you think back to those four near misses at Augusta that you've mentioned there, twice on two occasions, third on two occasions, do they come with many regrets for you, Retief, or do you look back on them as four great moments being at the very pinnacle of your career?
Yeah, I mean, what can you say? Over 4 days, yeah, only if I played one or two shots better. You know, somebody was just better than me by one or two shots. I mean, you know, Ernie Els has also finished second there how many times, and also had his chances. And then Phil Mickelson was there how many times he was second till he finally broke through. But yeah, it just didn't happen for me. It didn't happen for Ernie. You know, Louis Oosthuizen came so close to. And Charles Swartzel, obviously, and Trevor Immelman one day. It was great for South African golf. What I could have done better is, yeah, maybe, you know, one shot here and there in the water could have been different. But, unfortunately, there can only be one winner every week.
The 2002 Masters is the one that certainly sticks out for a multitude of different reasons. From a neutral standpoint, you look at that and you think about yourself versus Tiger on the final day of that tournament, and maybe the Tiger mania that had really got into full flow over the previous number of years coming into 2002 was certainly the story in golf. What was that like for you as a competitor, you know, teeing off alongside Tiger in the final pairing on that Sunday, realizing that you kind of have to focus on your own game while you realize that the glare is very much going to be on your opponent, quote unquote, that Sunday?
Yeah, I mean, that was always the tough thing playing with Tiger is the crowd that goes with it. He's definitely got like a 15th club in his bag, and he can use that crowd to intimidate or put the other player off. I had, 2002, I definitely had my chance. I got off to a slow start and then played well, and he got well ahead of me, and I had my chances for an eagle putt on 15 and a birdie putt on 16 and 17. if I made those, you know, we would have gone down the last all square. But so yeah, the putter left me there on the last few holes. Otherwise, it could have been a different story.
How real is the 15th club aspect? It's something that's often, you know, used as a phrase with regards to the Ryder Cup and maybe to a certain extent with the President's Cup and certainly with a lot of team events in golf, the sort of home venue aspect. But it really did feel like a massive aspect for the entirety of Tiger's career, like not least to 2019, just the extraordinary scenes on the final day when he won his last major. Going up against that, going into the face of that, how intimidating is that as a golfer, even as a man who's well known as having ice in his veins?
Yeah, I mean it. You know, it is difficult in a way of blocking it out. What's going on? You know, there's times that Tiger will putt it up to, let's say, 3 feet, and you got a 4 footer left, and he'll just say, you know, I'm going to finish, because he knows he knocks it in. You still got 4 feet left, and all the crowd starts running off to the next tee, and the noise and everything just goes with it. So, I mean, he was the guy to beat, and used every aspect of his game and everything that goes with it to win. And I suppose I would have done the same if I was in that boat, maybe playing in an event in South Africa or something. And so it is for every other sport, like you say, the Ryder Cup or tennis or whatever. You get the crowd on your side, it becomes difficult for the other side.
How much of a talker would you have been in those moments, Retief? I'm not sure. Is your general setting to chat away to your playing partner and you turn that right down or potentially turn it right up on the final day of a major?
No, the final day of a major, there's definitely not this discussing dinner tomorrow, that night, or anything like that. You know, some players might have a little chat, but it's pretty much all business down there. You're playing as a two ball, so you're playing fairly quick. You have to, you know, keep up, and there's not much time for chitter chatter, and you got to get to the ball and get going, you know. And in a major, you need every minute. It take your time and be sure what you're trying to do out there. Yeah, and obviously practice rounds are different. You know, you're discussing pretty much everything. But you know, it was I don't think I've ever played a practice round with Tiger over the years. You know, he's a guy that normally goes out at 6:30 in the mornings before everything starts going wild. And I always tried to tee off more or less during the same times what my tee times were for the event. Try and get a feel for how it plays around that certain time of the day.
Because I presume Tiger would have been pretty tense in that final round in 02, insofar as he would show that tension. Like this was not a stellar final round by his standards, or certainly by some of the rounds that we've seen him put up at Augusta during his peak. Like a final round of 71, it was a far from flawless performance from him as well. So even if he started off the day in relatively chatty form, I'm sure he goes into himself as he realizes that he's got to knuckle down here.
Yeah, like I said, the course was playing tricky, and you know, at the end of the day, you just got to do what it takes to win an event. And he just did what he did. I made the mistakes, and then came back a little, and then had my chances to really catch up at the end, and just didn't make the putts. Yeah, golf's a funny thing. You know, you shoot 71 and you win, and other days you shoot 65 and lose. You just got to catch the right moment and the right day to pull it off.
When you say that your putter let you down in the closing stages of 2002, I would, however, be right in saying that the putter was the thing that put you into contention on a couple of occasions at Augusta. It seemed that, you know, given how difficult it is in pretty much every part of the course, or so it seems watching on television, you definitely had an amazing command of those greens. So did that make it extra frustrating coming down the home stretch in 02 that almost your strongest aspect sort of
Yeah, I
deserved
mean,
it.
putting definitely was a strong part of my game back then. I was never a really great driver of the ball, so I was always putting for pars on some of the holes, and making those saves is huge. Yeah, Augusta, the greens are extremely difficult, and you're going to be stuck with a lot of 5, 6 footers for pars. Because it's sometimes just almost impossible to really get a long putt close. 6 feet sometimes is a great putt to get it to 6 feet from the hole. Putting over that period was my strong part. Sometimes I could play 2, 3 events in a row without a three putt for those 3 events. My putter will save me, that's for sure, a lot of times.
Yeah. When you would rock up to Augusta, would you prefer for the greens to be in their most difficult form, given it is your strong suit?
Yeah, I like the greens whenever they were running 14 plus. I've always been somebody that more strokes at the ball and not hit at the ball on the greens. The slower greens got, the worse my pace seems to get, because it feels like I have to really hit at the ball to get it to the hole. While on quick greens, it's just a sort of a smooth hit, and off it goes. The ball's going to get there. When you're putting up in slow greens, sometimes for me, I find it more difficult to get the right pace.
It speaks to a real natural gift on the greens. Is that the truth, Retief? Always growing up as a junior golfer, was it just something that you seem to have innately?
I think so. I always seem to have been a good putter, and putting is a part of the game that there's no strength involved or anything like that. It's purely you got to start the ball on the right line. I don't care how you hold it, how you putt at it, or anything like that. It is quite individual. Everybody has his own putter grip or his own setup with putting, while a golf swing seems to be all more everybody does the same thing. But I think the big key to putting is being able to read greens. You could have the best stroke in the world, but if you can't read the green, you're not going to make the putt. Visualizing the breaks, the speed it needs to go, you need to have a sense really of the land. You have to be able to. They're able to have a good sense of feel on the break.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just definitely not going to make. I mean, Ben Crenshaw was one of the greatest putters, and he was the same. He says, if you can't read greens, you can't make putts. And if you stand over the putt and you're not fully confident on your line and what you need to hit it at, you're not going to make a good stroke either. So it's a fine line. Putting is definitely, I think, more about being able to read greens well.
You would think then that with experience comes a greater capability to master, pardon the pun, Augusta National. Is that the case, or is it futile to ever expect that you'll conquer those greens?
Augusta, it's definitely the more you've played it and you get to know those greens, you have a little bit more advantage if somebody just goes out there the first time and play. Because some of the pin placings is quite deceiving. You think it's going to go left, but it actually goes right. That's why I say you need to really, after you hit your second shot on the green, that's when you start reading the green, and what you see the land, where the valleys are, all that kind of stuff, and you then walk onto the green, then you've already had an image in your mind about what the putt might do, because from what you've seen from 100 yards back. And Augusta is one of those with all the valleys and, you know, it's so hilly, Augusta. People don't realize how hilly it is. And so you really need to be able to see from a distance really what the putt's going to do already before you get onto the green.
Okay. Because of where you want to place your approach shot.
Well, yeah, I mean, the approach shot is obviously key at Augusta. Every time you get yourself above the hole there, it is tough to two-putt, never mind making the putt. Some of those greens, you know, 14 is one of those greens that you put yourself out of position on that green, you can putt it off the green. And you see that at a lot of majors. You know, it is about putting that second shot in the right place. If you've missed the fairway, then you're already struggling just to get on a green, never mind getting yourself in a position where you can have an uphill putt, because Augusta's uphill putts are running at 11. Yeah. Downhill putts are running at 16 plus. So it is the second shot is key always to try and – that's why you need to have a good knowledge of the greens to know where to leave it, to leave yourself the best putt.
Yeah, it seems that there's a bit more to it as well than just the approach out there. That's the obvious reason. It feels the way you're talking here, Atif, as if there's a psychological aspect of actually coming to terms with what's going to happen with the putter before that stroke actually takes place. Is that true?
Well, you know, most pros, and probably every pro, when you walk onto the tee, you play the hole backwards. The first thing you do on the tee is you look at where's the pin. Most of the players ask the caddy, where's the flag today? And they go, it's back right, for instance. So then, or let's say it's front right. So instantly you start working your game plan from the green back to the tee, because you're going, okay, the flag's front right. Coming in with a 60-yard shot, for instance, I'm not going to be able to stop it. So I actually now need to leave myself, let's say, 100 yards to be able to stop it. So now you hit something off the tee that's going to leave you 100 yards, which is going to make the second shot easier. If the pin was back right, you know, you have a lot of green to work with. Okay, I can hit driver and leave myself 60 yards because I got green to work with. So it's... It starts off, where's the flag, and then you work your way back to where you want to hit your second shot from, ideally to get it close, and then you try and hit your tee shot to that area where you think it's going to leave you the best approach.
The way you're talking there about your gift for putting is very much reminiscent of the sounds that Rory McIlroy has been making over the past couple of years, the way in which his team has helped him to rediscover his natural gift for putting. He made it a little bit too mechanical during that wait between majors for so many years. And once he rediscovered his own flow and trusting his own feel on the greens, his putting averages improved drastically. His career Grand Slam essentially comes as a result indirectly of that. When you hear Rory talk about that, are you nodding your head thinking, I know exactly what you mean, Rory, just trust the gift, trust the feel, don't get too bogged down by the coaching or the mechanics or the details?
Yeah, I mean, Rory, you know, is got the best golf swing in the world, best ball striker off the tee. I mean, if I could drive it like that kid can and hit the ball like him, and I had my putting back then, I don't know how many majors I would have won. And, you know, if Rory had a really great putting stroke, I think he would have been up there close to Tiger's majors by now. You know, there was times I'm watching him putting and I'm going myself, I wish I could just help him a little bit because I could see what he was doing. Finally, he started making some really good strokes, and you know, it's a fine line winning those majors. You know, it's like I say, it comes down to one or two shots. The U.S. Open, when Bryson won at Pinehurst, you know, Rory just couldn't make those couple of putts coming in, and it cost him. It's It's heartbreaking. You play so hard for 4 days and then you lose by one shot.
What were you thinking when you were watching Rory going through those putting struggles? Was there a specific aspect that you thought, geez, he needs to work on that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, what I saw on the TV at times, Rory wasn't releasing the putter. His hands got too far ahead when he strikes the ball, and he misses it right. So most of his putts, he misses right, and yeah, the hands were just not quite releasing the putter a little bit. It was just too much forward at impact, the hands.
Okay.
And that could be it. Could be a could be a putter setup thing that could cause that sometimes. It could be when you have too much loft on your putter that instinctively you feel the putt's going to go left, and you push your hands forward to try and take some of the loft off, and then you push the ball. I don't know. Like I say, I've never played with Rory. I've never been on a putting green with him or anything, but that's just what my observation. I mean, it's like we say, it's easy on the couch. You know, golf's easy on the couch to sit and watch and say, oh, he should have done that or should have done that. But that was just my observation. He just wasn't releasing the putter.
I think your opinion does count for more than 99.999% of people who are watching on the couch at the moment, to be fair, Atif. Am I right in saying that you would have backed yourself and gone without a coach for a lot of your career? And like, that's obviously not what Rory has done, but just this theme of, you know, trusting your own flow and your own game rather than allowing the mechanics to come into it too much. Was that the case in your career, speaking from
Yeah,
memory?
I didn't really stand with a coach behind me every week and every day. I worked with Gregor Jameson a little bit here at Lake Nona over the years, and we did our work the week before the tournament. I never really had him at a event because I feel like you should have done your work before you got to the tournament. And you know, some of these guys they stand at the Masters on a range for 6, 7, 8 hours. Practicing away and working on things. He should have done that last week in his week off. When you get to Augusta, you just get out on a course and play and learn the course. It's the time for mechanics is gone then. It's so easy these days to just get too much involved with the coaching. I personally feel and. You know, golf is feel. You could have the greatest swing in the world, but if you can't feel where the face and the club is, you're going to struggle to make a decent swing.
Did you indulge in a coach later in your career at all, or did you mostly go solo?
No, I do my own thing. I know what my issues are, and it's just, you know, keep working on that
Were you watching yourself back, Retief? Were you when you were saying when you say you knew what your own issues were, or like because a lot of people, again, this is speaking very much from an amateur standpoint. A lot of people don't understand their own errors purely by feel. They need to have somebody watch them and pick apart their game, or maybe even watch themselves. Did you at least have to do that and analyze your own game from a different vantage point?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, sometimes somebody might just see something that's just that little bit different to what you normally swing at, and you click. I mean, it is sometimes just a setup thing. It could be just a ball position thing. So I always tend to just go back to my basics thing, you know, start with a grip, start with a stance. Most of the time, it could be just a stance thing. Just the way something's like, I always had a tendency of getting a little bit too deep, too quick on my backswing. And then you just always keep working on, you know, feeling the club just being a little straighter back. But yeah, you know, at my age now, you can't stand on a range and go and bash 200 balls like you used to. You know, your body just won't allow it. You've got aches and pains and all that kind of stuff. But you hit balls, but I go out there and still hit some balls every day. Or but the short game, my short game, chipping is not really good. It's something I work hard on these days. I know I can chip better. But you know, on a Champions Tour, we don't play out of that much rough. We don't miss. You don't really tend to miss greens as much as you do on a regular tour, where you're playing more out of 4 or 5 inch rough.
Yeah. And just a couple of other things I wanted to ask you about. The 2007 Masters was an extraordinary week. Zach Johnson comes out on top with the joint highest score in terms of winning the competition in history. One over par is how he finished. That's one of the times, the other time that you finished second, you were in a tie for second with Sabatini and with Tiger as well. This kind of comes back to the point I was making earlier on about, you know, maybe you hoping for fast greens and which would challenge other putters compared to yourself. What were you thinking stepping onto the course, particularly? I think it was it the Saturday in 2007 that was particularly turbulent, just insanely high winds. It was chaos at Augusta that week.
Yeah, I mean, Augusta, I didn't like the course when it was raining, because some of those greens, when especially when it gets windy, it's so difficult to control the spin. I remember one time, I think I made an 11 there on number 15. You know, it's three balls in the water, my third shot, and then so on and so on. You just couldn't stop the ball from spinning back into the water. So I always liked Augusta when it was playing a little bit more on a firm side, that I know I can just make a nice swing at it and not having to worry about the ball zipping back too much. Yeah, I mean, the wind around Augusta is scary, in those valleys, in the trees. I remember the one time I was standing on the 12th tee to par three, and all three of us hit 7 iron there, and one ball went 10 yards over the green, the other ball went 10 yards short of the green, and one on the green. It can be just so, you can make so many good swings there and have zero result. Wind around Augusta is probably the hardest thing to work out, club selection. The ball just seems to do his own thing at times.
I'm just looking through the scores from that Saturday in 2007. You shoot a 70, but I'm pretty sure the next best score from the eventual top 10 was maybe a 72. Yeah, 72 from Tiger on the Saturday. So coming off the course with a 70 in brutal conditions, like that must be one of the most satisfying feelings at Augusta National that you can get, that you've been thrown haymakers for 3 and a bit hours and you've come away looking a little bit fresher than all your competitors.
Yeah, I mean, I always seem to play better on the tougher golf courses where a par is a good score. You know, when I play a tournament and the winning score is 24 under par, I never seem to have done well in those events. Because it's almost like more frustrating if you have to keep making birdies to keep up. While at a major and a tough conditions like that, if you make a par, you catch up. And I like that kind of grind, more, that knowing that, you know, if I make this putt, make a par, that I've caught up with the field. You know, some events you make a par, you move back 10 spots. No, I mean, Augusta, like I say, when the wind blows there, it is one of the trickiest golf courses to work out where the wind's coming from.
Retief, there are some people that when you have them on the show, you can ask the really unobvious questions or you can ask the really obvious question. As somebody who's never spoken to you on the show before, I feel it would be amiss of me to not ask you about the time you were struck by lightning. I know it's probably the one thing you got asked about more than anything else, but I'm unashamedly gonna bring it up because I suspect there might be one or two people out there who actually have not heard the story or are even familiar with the fact that this is something that happened in your life. So take us back to this moment. I'm not sure how traumatic it is for you to talk about, actually, Retief, but all
Well, I
yours.
can't really remember. That's the thing. Because when you get whacked by lightning, you don't feel anything, you don't hear anything. It just like I was on a golf course, and the next moment I woke up, I was in hospital. It is so instant, should I say. And, you know, for me, the lucky thing was that I was playing with my cousin Henry that day, and he was sort of 20 yards ahead of me. Well, even him got knocked over when the lightning whacked me. Turned around and saw me lying there smoking away, pretty much burnt to pieces. He ran off to people he saw a couple of holes away, and luckily one of them was a doctor. And the guy came back and revived me, and they managed to get a car on a golf course and drive me off to the hospital. So when I woke up, I was there in hospital, not knowing a single thing what happened. You know, it is just, I suppose it's like when you go for an operation, they put you out and you wake up, I didn't see any lights or like I was going anywhere or the big man was looking at me or anything like that. It's a weird feeling. It makes you think really what happens today when it's your time, what happens. But luckily, you know, all my injuries, my heart picked up a little bit of a crack, a heartbeat, and through exercise and fitness, strengthened it all up. He's good now. I lost a bit of hearing in my left ear from the lightning. But otherwise, I'm still going. Maybe it's time for a lightning to hit me again and spark my game a little bit, because my golf turned pretty good after I got hit by lightning.
What age were you?
I was 15, 16. I was nearly 16, yeah. So I was lucky, yeah, to get away from that.
I presume it was a club that conducted the lightning.
Oh, I don't know. I was carrying my own golf clubs at the time.
But it wasn't mid-swing?
No. It was just, we were walking after we teed off. And we actually did stop for a while because there was lightning around. But back then, there was none of the mobile phones. You can check what's going on. Or there was sirens or things going off, like, get off the golf course. We stopped, and it looked like it cleared, and we carried on. And obviously, it hasn't cleared out, and I was chosen.
I don't want to diminish your own experience in this, but given the fact that you remember none of it, and your cousin had to witness all of it, how did he get on after that? That's like an unbelievable. I presume he's a similar age to you.
Yes, he is. You know, I sat down with dinner with him probably about 3-4 years ago again now. And, you know, he went through the whole story, how traumatic it was, because I was just lying there, you know, pretty much blown out of my clothes and burnt everywhere and blood coming out of my nose and ears and looking like a dead person, really. And for him, it must have been you know, what do you do? He said at one stage he stuck his finger in my mouth because it looked like I swallowed my tongue. You know, at the age of 15 to go through that, it must have been pretty traumatic for him. And yeah, what do you do? It's just me and him out there. And he started running and he saw a group. And lucky for me, there was a doctor there. Otherwise, yeah, I would have been 6 feet under by now.
Wow. And like for your cousin, for your whole family, look, the fact that you make a full recovery is the most important thing. But I wonder, have you ever kind of got a sense of them maybe appreciating your career all the more because of how lucky you were to walk away from that incident? Like, did you get a greater sense of them appreciating the couple of major wins that you had? Because it's pretty extraordinary to come back from that and be a top-class sports person.
Obviously, I got saved for something bigger and sort of given a second chance is the word you can probably use. And for me, luckily, I finished school and then we did our 2-year military service back then, which was still compulsory. And straight after that, I turned pro. And here we are. 37 years later, still going at it, luckily. We're so lucky in golf that we can still compete at our age. So many other sports, when you're 35, you're done. And yeah, we are still playing on a Champions Tour out here now and still be able to compete and make a bit of money.
Yeah, for sure. Just before I let you go, Retief, your connection with home is obviously so pronounced and powerful. I know you're living in the States at the moment. People will have seen last year, maybe, one of the most, it's hard to put together a list of the most extraordinary things that we've seen in the White House over the past couple of years. But yourself and Ernie Els going along with the South African president to meet Donald Trump in May 2025. A really interesting interaction that occurred in the Oval Office that day. I guess for me, looking at that moment, and for you, when you actually get the phone call or whenever you are contacted by the South African president or his people, I guess that was a big moment for you to represent your country, to represent the South African people in one of the most powerful offices in the world. Was there ever any doubts in your mind about actually showing up that day?
Yeah. I've been in the White House a few times over the years, especially with the President's Cups, and met quite a number of presidents, and Donald Trump, I met a number of times too over the years. When the call really came from Ernie that do I want to go with him to the White House and have a little chat and see if we can get the South African government to maybe just start looking at things a little different and not carry on the way they're carrying on. I was in two minds, but I thought, okay, I'll do it. And we all got caught off guard a little bit by President Trump. We thought we were going to have a meeting first and then the press, but he did it the other way around. He did the press first and then a meeting afterwards. So we were all thrown in the boat there a little bit and had to say our say. And, I know what's happening in my area. And Ernie and Johan Rupert and a number of other guys said they say. Did it make a difference? I don't know. So far, not. No, nothing has really changed in South Africa for the better. But, it's still a great country. I was back there now for Christmas and New Year for 6-7 weeks. And at an absolute ball, it's such a. I don't think they realize really how a good country they do have down there, and the opportunities they have to really turn South Africa around and make it a big investable country again. But the way it's going now, there's more companies and people leaving than there is coming in, and unfortunately, that's why the economy is struggling.
And what is it that you want to see changed?
Well, it is just the pressure they unnecessarily putting on companies and farmers down there to with their rules. How do they want to incorporate the poorer people into the companies? The problem is you put this pressure on these companies, they have to actually start firing people. Because of the pressure that's on them for taxes and things like that, and they just physically can't support the amount of people that has to be hired, and then instead of maybe doing it the other way around, helping companies with less taxes and not having to do the what they call the BEE in South Africa and forcing them to employ people that isn't qualified to be part of the company. If they maybe take that away and take the heavy tax burden on some of these companies, those companies might start hiring more people and in that way create jobs and not getting rid of jobs. And the farmers, unfortunately, also, the farms that get taken away or the farmers that get murdered. These people got to realize the food doesn't come out of a supermarket. It comes from farms. Without food, nobody survives. So really, they should be really be protecting the farmers, helping them to create more jobs instead of punishing them because they have a farm. And these guys have to close down their farms, or they can't hire people because they have to pay so much unnecessary taxes and stuff just because they have a farm.
Okay, well, it sounds like it's a fairly divided place, Retief, at this
I
moment.
mean, yeah, it's divided the whole world at the moment, so divided. I mean, yeah, in America, the Republicans and Democrats are so, I mean, you wouldn't think these guys are trying to run the same country. It's amazing how politics has become so divided, and I think it happens in a lot of countries now that it's just a lot of finger pointing and no doing. It's just blame, 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 blame. It'd be nice if people actually start working together and talk and get things done.
For sure. I was going to ask you at the end for a master's tip. It feels trivial compared to that section of the conversation, but I may as well ask it anyways. Is there anybody that you like the look of?
Scotty has not been playing that great lately, so I'm not sure what his chances are, but you never know. Rory, he's swinging away as great as always. Get that putter going. He's going to be a big chance there. And yeah, I mean, I think the guy to watch is going to be Bryson. I think he's seems to be playing really well. He's got that great draw going at the moment that you need around Augusta. And the guy's fired up. He's playing great golf. I think he could be the guy on Sunday.
Well, enjoy it next week and the couple of days that you're going to have up in Georgia. Retief Goosen, a pleasure to have you on the show. Thanks so much for being so generous with your time.
Thank you.
Off the ball. GAA.
Not too many goals are scored outside the 21-yard line, and there's not too many players in the country that I'd back to score a goal from that distance out. Aaron Galan is one of them. He was outrageous, outrageous at the weekend.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.